Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, a cheap new medication to help you quit smoking. We'll use a couple of well-known RN broadcasters to illustrate a common voice issue and let you know what can be done about it, good news about living longer, and a story going around the world this week from a presentation at a major conference in the US and a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine. It seems that it's now possible to identify women with breast cancer which hasn't spread to lymph nodes who can get away without chemotherapy. For many years, chemo has been a mainstay of treatment following surgery to remove the cancer and is credited, along with radiotherapy, with a very significant improvement in survival. But now the game has changed thanks to a trial using gene testing. On the line from the Mater Hospital in Sydney is Professor Fran Boyle, a cancer specialist and researcher with an interest in breast cancer. She's here to explain. Welcome back to the Health Report, Fran.
Hello, Norman. It's a very exciting day.
It is. I mean, what proportion of women can now, with this kind of, we'll come to what the kind of breast cancer is in a minute, can escape chemotherapy?
Well, I think chemotherapy is fantastic if you need it, and it's fantastic if it's going to work for you. But if it isn't, then it's absolutely something to be avoided. And we think that the group that we're looking at here are people with what we call an intermediate risk cancer, not a really high risk cancer, not a really low risk cancer, but that sort of grey zone, or the ones where you sit on the fence and ponder. And what's fantastic is that additional information can help you work out who really is going to benefit.
So let's just talk about, because breast cancer has changed enormously and it's turned really breast cancer into a chronic disease rather than a fatal one for many, many women. But it's become, you know, you do all these tests on women. So just describe the sort of breast cancer these women had in this trial before you get onto the test itself.
So these would be women who've had surgery to remove a lump or a mastectomy. They've had some lymph nodes sampled under the arm, and they've had some standard pathology tests that we do all around the country. So they've got hormonal breast cancer, which you can tell from staining the slides. They don't have...
Meaning that it's positive. They've got receptors, lock-in key mechanisms for estrogen and progesterone.
That's exactly right. So that some of the growth of the cancer is being driven by estrogen. And we know that hormone-blocking drugs are very helpful for that group of women. So that's a standard test we would do here. It also is the kind of cancer that doesn't need Herceptin because it doesn't have that extra lock-in key of the HER2, and it isn't in the lymph nodes. So this is actually a pretty common kind of breast cancer we would pick up, particularly in older women who are in the screening age groups and are having breast screen, so their cancers are picked up at that earlier stage.
So what is this test?
So what the test does is it takes a piece of that pathology sample, in our case, sends it to America, and additional genes are looked at, which are not the inherited breast cancer genes, so not the ones that tell you whether you got it from your granny and your auntie, but the ones that are actually mutated in the cancer that are associated with growth and spread. And the test can come back with more or less three kinds of answers. One, low risk, don't worry about it.
And when you say low risk of recurrence or spread.
That's right. Number two can come back with, yes, up to a 30% risk of recurrence and spread, so we'd call that a high risk. And then there's the sort of fuzzy zone in the middle of the intermediate risk, and that's the group of people who were involved in this clinical trial called the TAILORx trial.
So the practice up till now has been, if you come back on this 21-gene test, low risk, you haven't been given chemotherapy.
That's right. So those are people with a very hormonal cancer, not growing quickly. Hormone blocking treatment should be enough to keep them safe.
So what did they find in this mid-range?
So what they found in the mid-range was that modern chemotherapy of the sort that we would give here did not have an extra benefit over modern hormone blocking treatment. So most of the women...
So this is like tamoxifen?
Younger women, tamoxifen. Older women, what we call aromatase inhibitors, so some of the newer hormone-blocking drugs. And these women were doing actually well without chemotherapy, and the half of the group who got chemotherapy actually weren't doing any better, and they were, of course, having more side effects. So in that circumstance, it would be a very good thing not to offer them chemotherapy. The high-risk group, yes, they benefit, and usually you can work that out from other features of the cancer.
But women 50 years or under still seem to benefit from the chemo.
It's that younger group where chemotherapy probably has an additional hormone-blocking effect. And so if you've got a very hormonal cancer and you're younger, chemo doesn't just work killing cells directly. It also knocks off cells in the ovary, and that reduces the amount of estrogen around. And so from lots of other trials that we've done, we know that that extra hormone blocking effect can be beneficial. So it isn't clear at this point what percentage of those younger women had their period stop, and that would be good to know.
And the so the women, just to be clear, stay on a hormone blocker, but they don't need chemo. And then there's this debate about women 50 years or younger. Mm-hmm. So if a woman's listening to this and she's in the middle of chemo for her breast cancer, and this sounds as if she fits it, should she stop? Should she talk to her oncologist about stopping?
Well, she should definitely talk to her oncologist about the basis on which the decisions were made. There are some other tests that are available in Australia that also categorise women in a similar way to lower or higher risk. So the Oncotype DX, which was the 21-gene test, is not the only way to address this. Some women will have had those tests, but they, like the Oncotype, are expensive.
And so this is not covered by Medicare?
None of these tests are presently covered by
Medicare.
How much
do they cost?
An Oncotype is about $4,500 Australian.
$4,500?
It is. And of course,
so who pays for this?
Well, not very many patients, in fact, because when the test is discussed with them, obviously that's a massive out-of-pocket expense at a time when they're having potentially other costs for surgery and the like.
But surely the cost of chemo swamps that?
Well, interestingly, in the US, the direct costs of chemotherapy are much higher than they are in Australia for a variety of reasons. And so in the US, it's the health funds, who actual health insurers, who pay for the test to try and stop people giving chemotherapy. And in that circumstance, it's very cost effective. And so we've seen over the last couple of years, since the Oncotype has been around in the US, the number of people getting chemotherapy is falling, and that's saving a lot of money. And in Australia, I think we've always had a more judicious approach to the use of chemotherapy in people with hormonal cancers. We've never been as gung-ho as the Americans. But I think you'd have to imagine that it would be cost-effective, as well as the human cost of having chemotherapy and its potential side effects.
So you're in a private cancer centre and you send it off and people get charged. In public hospitals, are people sending it off and the public system's coping with it?
No, the public system's not paying for it. So probably the only people who are having it done in Australia would be people who, by their reading, have learnt about it and have decided it's worth the investment, and who've had that discussed with them by their health professional.
Interesting. And no doubt a bit of lobbying is going to go on. Fran, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Norman.
Professor Fran Boyle, who's director of the Ritchie Centre for Cancer Care and Research at the Mater Hospital in Sydney, and associate professor and professor of medical oncology at the University of Sydney. You're listening to the Health Report here on RN, ABC News and CBC Radio across Canada. I'm Norman Swan. There are various ways to quit smoking. Some people do it cold turkey, some do it with nicotine replacements, some take a medication called varenicline, and some people take support from the Quit Line to get through the ups and downs and occasional failures before success. In Europe, though, there's a herbal compound called cytisine, which has had some evidence to support its use. It's a fraction of the cost of varenicline, and a trial has commenced in Australia with a view to getting it approved for use. The person running the trial is Ryan Courtney of the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. Welcome to the Health Report, Ryan.
A pleasure to be here, Norman.
Thanks. What exactly is cytisine?
Cytisine is a natural plant extract. It's commonly found in the laburnum plant throughout Europe, but there is lots of species here in Australia that do also contain the cytisine extract.
How does it work, if it works at all?
Okay, so it works as a smoking cessation medication, and it tries to reduce, well, it does actually, been shown to reduce cravings and withdrawal symptoms for smokers when they're undergoing a quit attempt.
And there's a purified form of it available?
It's a 1.5 milligram that goes into a capsule or a tablet at the moment.
Now, what evidence is there that it works?
So the current evidence, there's been a couple of really high quality studies. So two placebo control trial studies, as well as one head-to-head pragmatic trial that compared it to nicotine replacement therapy with over 1,200 smokers in New Zealand. And it was found to be more effective than nicotine replacement therapy for cessation or quitting. And yeah, so it's quite promising in terms of the results, but there's been no head-to-head comparison compared to varenicline or Champix, which is currently the frontline and best smoking cessation medication currently available in the world. And that's what we're trying to establish, is whether or not it is just as effective as varenicline for quitting.
So you swallow a capsule, how many times a day?
It's quite a number of tablets per day. It's a shorter course. It's only 25 days compared to varenicline, but it does, the dosing regime does, similar to varenicline, include a number of tablets per day over a period of 25 days.
And it's cheaper?
Well, that's what we're looking at. We're trying to find out the effectiveness, so what the rates of cessation look across both groups, and then compare the healthcare costs associated with using cytosine. But at the moment, it looks like it will be a lot cheaper, as it is a natural plant extract that is easily manufactured.
So why isn't it approved here if there's a couple of trials, one in Europe, one in New Zealand? I think there's more than that, actually, showing that it works. Isn't that enough to get the authorities to approve it?
So I guess it's a case of it's a medication that's had a very unconventional history with, if you were to talk to someone in Russia or even parts of Eastern Europe, they'd say, well, why aren't you guys using cytosine? But it generally is.
Why aren't we?
Yes, yeah. Why aren't we in Australia? And it's generally an artifact of trying to get more high quality evidence with larger studies like we're doing, and also trying to look at not just effectiveness, but safety as well. So the current studies haven't been done to the highest contemporary standards that are required. And it wasn't until about mid-2000s when the really big placebo control trial study came out, and there was a review that looked at cytosine's efficacy and found that it did look positive. And then the head-to-head trial happened in New Zealand against nicotine replacement therapy, and the results were quite positive and interesting.
What are the side effects?
The side effects are currently mild to moderate, slight gastrointestinal symptoms, but not unusual compared to some of the other medications that are currently available, like nicotine replacement therapies and varenicline. We're not necessarily expecting a higher rate, but we'll be carefully tracking adverse events throughout the study when participants are in the study to get to that outcome.
And what you're looking for is a quit rate?
Yes, that's exactly right, Norman. Yes, yeah.
And if somebody wants to participate in the trial, what's involved?
So what's involved is generally, first of all, an expression of interest, so they can find out about our study through your website, of course, on the health report. And they'll call up or email and go through an eligibility or screening process. So they have to be a daily smoker. Currently, we're only recruiting through the Sydney metropolitan and a little bit wider area at the moment.
Oh, so it's a bit of a problem for our Perth listeners. Okay.
Yeah, it does make it a little bit harder, but that's the limitations of a clinical trial, where you have to look at the outcome as well, which is often validated self-report.
Has the horse bolted here? I mean, are herbalists flogging this already for smoking?
No, I don't think the horse has bolted. If it had, a lot of people would have access to it and using it, particularly not just in Australia as a potential option, but also in low to middle income countries where currently the price of smoking cessation medications is just cost prohibitive.
Well, in return for letting you advertise for more people on your trial, we hope to get the results first here on the Health Report.
Yeah, well, definitely, for sure, Norman. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Right. That's very good. Ryan Courtney, who is a research fellow at the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. Now to an aspect of getting older that you've probably not thought about too much. It's called presbyphonia. And if you're wondering what that is, a couple of broadcasters you know well have it. Here's Robin Williams on The Science Show in 2003, followed by him on The Science Show in 2018.
Hello, I'm Robin Williams, and today's Science Show looks at the sky, the planets and beyond, beginning closer to the Earth with the weather and the proposition that 140 million people could soon move to Australia from Asia. This is The Science Show, which this time brings you good plastic, costly carbon storage, heart repair, fishes that think they're farlap, and the tropical challenge of our region. And there's also a farewell to the dinosaurs. What more do you want?
Well, what more do you want might be Philip Adams in 2003 and in 2018.
Tonight we've got a sort of a psychoanalytic team who are going to look at another of the major players in this in the forthcoming war, whom I'll identify shortly. Then a little later in the program, we'll have the charming Michael Ondaatje with us yet again, this time not to talk about poetry or literature, but a branch thereof. He wants to discuss his love of the filmmaking process.
Imagine, beloved listeners, a world without engineers. Abandon Archimedes, Bessemer and the rest, and what would you see? Well, pretty much zero, nothing. In a world without engineers, no skyscrapers, no steel, no elevators, no houses, no sewers.
That's presbyphonia, the change in your voice as you age. And I assure you, I'd have used my voice if it wasn't so youthful compared to Adams and Williams. And to be fair, you know, and thank you very much to Philip and Robin for letting me use their voices to illustrate this phenomenon. Well, a study in the United States has looked at why some people are bothered by presbyphonia. Clearly, Philip and Robin aren't, and not others. Here's Brianna Crawley, an ear, nose and throat surgeon at Loma Linda University in California.
What we were trying to do with this project was, why is it that some people have presbyphonia, an old-sounding voice, and complain about it, and some people don't, if we're all aging? So what are the characteristics of presbyphonia that make it bothersome to a person, enough so that they would come to the doctor?
So if you've got presbylaryngitis, would you know that you've got presbylaryngitis as opposed to presbyphonia?
You would only know it by looking. So we would do an examination of the larynx and see the signs of presbylaryngitis, which they actually include loss of tissue, so loss of the vocalis muscle, loss of the superficial lamina propria, and potentially changes in the cover itself of the epithelium of the vocal fold.
So what did you do in this study?
We have quite a number of elderly people and patients who are otherwise fairly healthy. So they're ambulatory elderly patients. And the highest proportion of these in the United States.
You beat even Florida.
In this little community in Loma Linda, we have a large number of very elderly patients. So we utilize that patient population to look at 75 and older. We wanted to know, of these elderly people who are ambulatory, who walk in the door of our clinic, why do some of them complain of an aging voice or presbyphonia, or what we call pathologic presbyphonia because it bothers the patient? And why do so many of them not complain?
And how did you define presbyphonia?
Pathologic presbyphonia was defined by the patient. We asked them whether or not their voice bothered them. The typical complaints are weak voice, hoarseness, not being audible in groups of people.
And when you then looked for the features of people who were complaining of problems with their voice as they aged, what did you find?
The interesting thing was that we found that both our pathologic presbyphonia groups, as defined by the patients themselves, compared with our control group, as well as overall general health and a questionnaire to determine education level, working status, marital status, living situation. And we found that the groups were extremely homogeneous, right down to their physical exam findings were very similar. Their acoustic and aerodynamic measures were very similar. But the one thing that we found that was different was that the voice handicap index and the voice-related quality of life questionnaires both had worse scores in the pathologic presbyphonia group. So that was consistent with what the patients were telling us.
So what you're saying is, fascinatingly, is that as you age, your voice gets a bit weaker and it bothers some people, not others. So in other words, between your two groups, they both had presbyphonia at the same rate. It's just bothering one group more than another.
Right. The one thing that we found that was kind of interesting was that people with a lower maximum phonation time, which is the amount of time that they can sustain a phonation, trended towards being lower in the people who were complaining, which would indicate potentially a respiratory capacity issue.
Modal phonation?
Right in the middle of their range, a comfortable pitch, they would essentially say a note for as long as they could in the middle of their comfortable range.
So this is
with as much air as they could take in.
So it's like take a deep breath and go, something like that.
That's it. People who were coming in less than 12 seconds ended up being more likely to be in the pathologic presbyphonia group.
Were these people depressed or anything like that?
Not depressed. Using their voices for the same kinds of things, church, socializing, phone. The other slight trend that we found was that women were more likely to have pathologic presbyphonia than men.
Did you manage to control for radio broadcasting, you know, the exercise of the voice as part of your vocation?
Right. We always joke about that because it seems like potentially women are complaining about this more, but women actually seem to have less presbylaryngis than men, or less evident presbylaryngis than men. And we always joke that that's because women exercise their vocal folds so much.
Is there anything you can do about it?
Voice therapy can help a lot, but you also have various vocal fold augmentation procedures. So you can, it was popularized as the voice lift, where you can do a vocal fold injection augmentation with various different substances. That actually provides additional bulk within the vocal fold so that your voice gets stronger. So those are temporary. You can also do permanent implant placement.
And what does voice therapy do?
There are different categories of patients with presbyphonia, and some of them have respiratory capacity issues. Some of them have glottic incompetence. Some of them have subtle coordination issues, and speech therapists can help a tremendous amount with this. This has been particularly effective in my patients who are men that are teachers or professors or lawyers who have to speak in front of people for long periods of time. Speech therapists really make a difference in that group of patients, and voice therapy and exercises.
Brianna Crawley, thank you so much for joining us on the Health Report.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Brianna Crawley is an ear, nose and throat surgeon at Loma Linda University in California. A paper in this week's Medical Journal of Australia has good news about the extent to which Australians are living longer. John McNeill is one of the authors. John is Professor of Epidemiology and Preventive Medicine at Monash University and is in our Melbourne studio. Welcome back to the Health Report, John.
Thank you, Norman.
I thought we already knew it was good news.
I think that's exactly right. But the reason we published this paper is that the extent and the implications of living longer really haven't sunk in. And I think this paper was designed to present in a very simple way what some of these implications are.
What did you do?
We basically simulated the experience of 100,000 men and women who were alive at age 20, and we examined how many of them would have died by the age of 70. That's death in middle age in 1960.
You're calling 70 middle age. That's very comforting.
Well, it's comforting to me.
Yeah, I've got 25 years to go, so really, doesn't it? Anyway, carry on.
So we looked not only...
So is this sorry, just before you go on, is this vanity publishing then, John? Are you calling it 70 middle age?
I think so. I think it's what in a normal advanced society people would expect to live to. I think people who die before 70 would be thought of as having premature mortality.
So you compared... So you did... It was mathematical modelling, basically. You compared people who might have been 20 in 1960 to 20 in 2010. Is that what you did?
Yes, for between 20 and 70, looking at the experience of a 1960 mortality rates and 70, 80, 10-year intervals up to 2010.
So what did you find when you did that?
Well, I think it surprised us a little, just the extent of it, because I think fundamentally, back in 1970, when the death rates in Australia in middle age were at their peak, nearly half of men had died before they were 70. And this has fallen now to about 18%. And similarly with women, about 28% of women had died before 70, and this has now fallen to 11%. So that's a very dramatic fall in mortality.
So life expectancy has been going up, what, 3 months a year, year in, year out. And has our life expectancy in Australia been going up faster than that? I mean, that seems like a very dramatic difference in about, what, 50 years?
It is a very dramatic.
But is it more than 3 months a year, or it fits with that metric?
I think it's probably not quite 3 months, but it fits with most other Western societies, although I'll talk in a minute perhaps about the experience in the US, which hasn't been quite so heavy.
No, they've had a bit of a reversal with opioids and various other things. So what other causes then of this happy circumstance?
Well, the most important cause is the decline in deaths from heart disease. And I must emphasise it's deaths from heart disease, not necessarily the incidence of heart disease. But back in 1970, when I graduated, there was about 29% of men had died before 70 of heart disease. And that's fallen to 5%. That's a fall to one-sixth of what it was. In women, it's fallen from about 16% to 2%. And that's probably due equally perhaps to prevention, things like reduced smoking, better diet, etc. But also another, at least another 50% by better medical care. And that's been
so
the
really
dramatic.
So this is cholesterol reduction, blood pressure reduction and things like that.
Yes, all of those things. But that has been a really quite an amazing
and it's stroke,
change.
And it's stroke as well. It's not just heart attacks.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Strokes have fallen. I've included as cardiovascular disease as a whole, which is stroke and heart disease.
Now, you make the comment in the paper is you've got to die of something. And in this case, it's now increasingly cancer.
Oh, yes, absolutely. When I graduated, wards were full of middle-aged men with heart disease and deaths were very common. In fact, a death from heart disease in middle-aged was about five times as common as it was from cancer, but now twice as many men and women die of cancer than heart disease before 70.
So you address the implications of this because you talk about disability in this group of people and you talk about dementia. I mean, I thought that basically you got to 70 now, but you got to 70 in pretty good shape. You're biologically probably, 55 or 60 compared to 1960. And therefore, the disability rate is shifted, time shifted to 80 years of age and 90. But you're saying that that's not happening?
Oh, no, I think there is a general improvement in health. But we do run across the fact that over 70 and particularly over 80, the chronic intractable diseases become more common, in fact, very common. And the issue of dementia becomes particularly important, affecting up to a half of people in the latter part of their 80s.
But that's coming down, just like cancer's coming down, so is dementia, isn't it?
Well, it depends. The risk is a little less, but the absolute numbers, because there's so many more people, is increasing very sharply.
So what do you think should be done that's not being done to acknowledge these changes in statistics?
I think that in the past, we've thought of preventive medicine as very largely improving the health of middle-aged people, and I still think that's incredibly important. And I think
particularly if they're now 70 years old rather than 50.
I think that it's really important to maintain careful observation so that we can maintain these advances. But as well as that, I think we have to start thinking much more about how we're going to improve the healthy lifespan of people over the age of 70, just delaying the onset of disability and delaying the onset of dementia.
Is there something magical that we aren't doing that we should be doing? I mean, or is it just more of the same?
Look, I think this is there's a lot of work that needs to be done. There's not been a lot of studies of the interventions in the older people that might keep them alive and healthier for longer. And this is going to be an increasingly important economic issue, I think. Just advancing dementia, for example, by 1 or 2 years could save the community a very large amount of money.
Indeed. John McNeil, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Norman.
John McNeil, who's Professor and Head of the Department of Epidemiology and Preventive Medicine and Head of the School of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Monash University in Melbourne. This has been The Health Report. I'm Norman Swan. I hope you can join us next week.